You're listening to a Bell & Cat Discord server stage talk titled Getting Started in Open Source Research. This week we were joined on stage by OSINT analyst Sophia Santos. Sophia works at the Center for Information Resilience, an independent non-profit social enterprise dedicated to exposing human rights abuses and war crimes, countering disinformation, and combating online behavior harmful to women and minorities. During the talk, she walked us through her route into open source research and shared some invaluable tips on how to focus your efforts in order to gain a job in the industry. You can find all the links mentioned in the talk in the description of this podcast. The talk was hosted by me, Charlotte Marr, on Wednesday the 5th of June in the Bellingcat Discord server. It's worth mentioning that during the course of the podcast, there was some explicit language used. Welcome to this week's Bell & Cat Stage Talk. This week, we're joined by Sophia Santos, an OSINT expert and longtime Bell & Cat Discord member who currently works as an analyst at the Center for Information Resilience. Sophia is also the owner and author of the blog website, Grelix.com. Grelix is a useful resource for those looking to practice open source research skill sets. Sophia posts regular exercises challenging strangers to have a go at the puzzles. You can then find the answers in helpful guide videos. Sophia also writes and records video tutorials for basic research skills, teaching you how to do geolocation, for example, to even knowing how to embrace your own mistakes. Today, Sophia is here to share some advice for people who are new to the industry and want to get involved. We'll be discussing routes into research and what traps to avoid. And yes, you'll get a chance to ask your questions too. As we talk, please put your questions in the chat and I'll ask them as we move into the Q&A section. Sophia, it's your turn. Please take the mic and I'll pop back in a little bit to ask you some questions.
Thank you. Okay, so hello everyone. My name is Sophia. I am Portuguese. And I work for the Center for Information Resilience as the OSINT team lead on one of their many, many projects. I investigate human rights violations, security incidents, armed conflict, and terrorist activity, among many other exciting things. I focus on a very specific area of the globe, which shall remain unidentified for security reasons. Sorry about that. In addition to working on my own investigations, I also lead the extremely talented OSINT team within that project. Right, so how did I get you to OSINT in the first place? I hope you're ready for this because I'm not sure if I am. So the story begins in the late 90s, early 2000s, the early stages of the internet. Like any cool teenager at the time, I was spending a lot of my free time online. The internet was this amazing new thing. But the internet from 20 odd years ago was very different from what we have now. Security was almost non-existent, which was very good or very bad, depending on what you're trying to do. Things were less connected and information was hard to find and even harder to piece it together. So everything felt scattered and unorganized, if that makes sense. It was, however, a very exciting time to be a teenager. I talked to a lot of people, I met a few, I learned loads of new things, and I was having a blast. Unfortunately, this was also the time that I met a person who later became my stalker. So I'm not sure what I did to trigger his obsession or if I did anything at all, but he remained a continuous presence in my life for about 5 years. He knew where I lived, he knew my friends, he knew my family, and he held a gun to my head. And I was too young to know how to handle it, so I tried telling my friends, but no one really believed me because he was a very charming person. They thought he was, you know, I was perhaps overreacting or misunderstanding his good intentions. But his intentions were not good, and I knew that. So I did what I had to do. You know, I cut everyone off and I stayed indoors for almost 2 years. You know, that's what I had to do to survive. And because I was a minor, sometimes I was still forced to leave the house to do things with my family, you know, like everyone else. But in general, for those 2 first years, the internet became the only safe way for me to interact with the outside world. But it wasn't completely safe because my stalker also knew how to find me online. So over time, I figured that the best way to keep myself safe was to first be very good at hiding my online presence and second, to track down his movements. Because if I knew where he was going to be or what he was planning to do before he found out what I was doing, I could avoid him and stay safe. So the hunter became the hunted. And that's how I got myself into OSINT without realizing. I became very good at finding information, tracking movements, analyzing patterns, and making informed decisions based on that data. At that time, I did not know it was OSINT, of course. I was just trying to stay alive. Eventually, those two first years went by. I started getting confident enough. I left the house. I enrolled in uni. And as soon as I completed my degree, I was out. I left my country. I moved a lot, lived in many countries, maintained a very low online presence, you know, just in case. I had many jobs. I did a lot of very cool things, but nothing to do with computers, nothing to do with security, nothing to do with open source investigation. I was kind of a hermit, honestly. I went from mostly living online those first 2 years to barely being online the moment I left my country. In fact, I lived in a few areas of the globe with none or very, very limited internet access for a while, but that was fine because I was safe. And that was my life for a very long time. But the story obviously doesn't end here, does it? So we're going to fast forward a lot to 3 years ago, more or less. We're in the middle of the pandemic, there's lockdowns, and there's boredom. I was so bored. And somehow I found myself stuck at home again. But this time it wasn't just me, it was all of us, so it's fine. The world outside was a bit scary again for a completely different reason this time. And so during my boredom, I once again had to resort to go online to experience the world. We all did it in this time. But what I was yet to find out is that my experiences with my stalker 20 years earlier had conditioned how I interacted with the internet. Because during those first years online, I almost obsessively explored, gathered info, and analyzed everything. Because the internet was a tool that allowed me to feel in control of my life, but I had to have full control of that tool. So during lockdown, I got really, really into ethical hacking because it was something I had already done back in the day. Although I'm not even going to pretend that what I was doing back in the early 2000s was ethical, it was most definitely not ethical. I was just a bit naughty then, but that's fine. I did what I had to do. However, whilst looking into ethical hacking this time, I came across the concept of OSINT and everything felt very familiar. I had done this before and I loved it because, like I said, it gave me a sense of control. So I started exploring more about this newfound concept and got absolutely hooked on geolocation specifically. I was fascinated and terrified by how much information you could get from a single image, which is why my camera is off. I'm sorry about that. I'm not giving you that data. And I enjoyed solving geolocation and OSINT challenges online and then reading people's walkthroughs. I also felt there were not that many around. So I decided to create a blog and start writing my own walkthrough so other people could also learn. I had written about 8 of them when one day I was on Twitter and I saw Nina, the then vice president for the Center for Information Resilience, asking for volunteers to help geolocate and verify data showing the Russian military buildup by the Ukrainian border. This was the 23rd February 2022, the day before the full-scale invasion. The tweet said they were looking for people with Ukrainian and Russian language skills and women. And I thought to myself, I cannot speak neither language, but I am a woman, so fuck it, I'm doing this. So I sent an email to CR with a short message offering my services, a link to my LinkedIn to prove I was a real person and a woman. That's the only thing I had going for me at the time. And the link to my blog to show I was at least capable of geolocating stuff. I was full of undeserving confidence. That's just how I live life anyway. So somehow they replied, they got me in, and I started working through the already massive database of the Eyes on Russia project. I did this for about 2 days. On my third day, I was offered a full-time position as an OSINT analyst working on a different project. So I'm still on that same project now, but over the past 2.5 years, I rose up to be the OSINT team lead. So for the first year, however, I worked on the two projects at the same time, my full-time paid job and then my free time on the Eyes on Russia project as a volunteer. So I was doing 8 hours a day on my normal one, plus a minimum of 3 hours each evening and full weekends on the Eyes on Russia project from the moment I woke up to the moment I went to bed. It was intense. It was very, very intense. So I went from casually geolocating random pictures online to verify data from a war zone to then get hired as an OSINT analyst in a matter of 3 days. And to give you an even better sense of perspective on the timeline of these events, I had done my first geolocation ever 2 months before I got the job offer. And I feel like I was possibly on the right place at the right time with the right set of skills. I'm not even going to pretend I was some sort of prodigy. It was most definitely a combination of luck, lots of confidence, and a lot of dedication. So during my first year as an official OSINT analyst, I kept writing geolocation walkthroughs and tutorials on my blog. Honestly, I have no idea how I even found the time for that. I probably wasn't sleeping much, but I was having lots of fun, so it's fine. I start getting people messaging me, asking how to get into OSINT. How do you start? How do you learn how to do all these cool things? And I kept answering them because I just answer everyone, which is very bad. But anyway, I kept telling people to just go for it. Explore the internet, find images, analyze them, notice the details, connect dots. Everything made sense in my head because that's how I always interacted with the internet. I observed everything. I analyzed everything. I had to, wasn't it? I didn't even know how to do it in any other way. But I felt people weren't really understanding what I was trying to convey. Just do it wasn't enough. And I wasn't sure how to explain it better because it was just so obvious to me. So now I look back, I understand that this was due to how I learned how to interact with the internet back in the early 2000s when I had a stalker. Most people didn't go through that. So the internet was a completely different space for them. They interacted with it in a more casual, relaxed way, which, if I'm honest, I kind of envy. The internet was a battleground for me. It was not a place to relax. So like I said, I kept answering people, working on both projects a lot and creating content. And by the end of that first year, I was completely and utterly burned down. I was physically and mentally done. I was a complete wreck. But by then, the Eyes on Russia project was well established, had funding, wasn't relying on volunteers. So I decided I had to step back. I need a break. I couldn't do it anymore. And that's how I found myself with a lot of free time that I hadn't even realized existed. And because I still kept getting messages from people wanting to learn about OSINT, I thought to myself, you know what? Let me show you what I mean. Because to just explore the internet advice was clearly not enough. I now had the free time to do it, so I did. You know, fuck sleep, right? Who needs to sleep anyway? So in January 2023, I created my first 5 exercises and released them on my website in short succession. They all have the exact same format. They start with a very small briefing providing some basic context. Then there's some initial data to analyze. This can be a photo, a video, a link, or just text. Then you get a small list of tasks to complete at a rate based on difficulty level. People can solve the tasks however they want it. None of them are impossible, but they do vary a lot in difficulty. I mark them as either easy, medium, or hard and separate them by beginner or expert level. So you can choose to start with tasks that I deem easy for beginners, for example, and work your way up until you're comfortable enough to start tackling the ones that are harder, or you could just jump straight to the more challenging ones aimed at the experts. Your call, whatever floats your boat, really. The exercises are all centered on the 3 main skills I believe are fundamental for someone to become a good OSINT analyst. How to find data, how to verify data, and how to analyze data. Everything on my website is free. I don't even have ads. I hate ads. None of the exercises requires people to use any paid tools or spend any money on anything. It's just using your brain and open source data. That's it. So within the first 24 hours of publishing an exercise, I released a full video walkthrough on my YouTube channel showing how I solved all tasks. I feel like when you're a beginner, watching someone do it in front of you step by step is extremely helpful. So I show everything, no cuts, apart from when I swear too much and I think to myself, oh, let me just edit this one out. But the most important thing for me in my videos is just I explain why I'm doing things. It's not just a click here, then there, and voila, you get the answer. I narrate out loud what is going on in my head, which is a very dangerous thing sometimes, but it's also very helpful. So if people tried and failed to solve a task, they can watch me do it and then try to replicate. Afterwards, when they're faced with a similar situation, they'll know what to do. I also urge people to write walkthroughs explaining how they solve the challenges. I then link them on the corresponding exercise page so others can read and learn alternative methods. Because there's never just one way to do things, I'm not like the ultimate OSINT person, there's many people to learn from. And because people still kept messaging me, I created a frequently asked questions page on my website with some guidelines on how to get into OSINT as a career. In the past years, I have advised many people on what to do to break into the field. Some of them, I'm very, very proud to report, already work as OSINT analysts, so well done for them. So what is my general advice? First thing you need to do is to figure out exactly what you would like to do, because OSINT is an umbrella term to refer to intelligence obtained through open source. It can be used on a number of fields such as human rights, like I do, cybersecurity, private investigation, journalism, etc. And the skills required can be very different from each other. You'll be working with open source data, but using different methods for different goals. Once you have decided what type of OSINT you're drawn to, I suggest finding organizations or people who work in that field and see what they are doing. Many will have public profiles and you can see what sort of things they discuss, they share, and they engage with. This will enable you to understand what skills they possess and what skills you should aim to develop. Then you can start working on those skills. I think my exercises are a good resource once you get to this stage, especially if you're someone who needs a bit of structure in their learning. I still think that the best way to learn OSINT skills is just to observe and analyze everything, but having some structured tasks might be quite useful as well. And that's why I created them. So explore the exercises. I would advise, if you are a beginner, to start with the easy ones. Don't try to be a hero and go for the hard tasks, as you may end up frustrated. It's best to build up the skills and the confidence alongside them. You don't need to prove anything to anyone. This is not a race. Once you get to a point where you're capable of solving the tasks without any help, whether they're easy or hard ones, write about it. Create a blog, a website, a Twitter thread, whatever floats your boat. Learning to transfer your thoughts into words is extremely helpful in this field of work. A great OSINT analyst has to be able to write great reports. And you don't need to just write exercise walkthroughs. You can write about anything you want. It's a matter of showcasing what you're capable of. That's what you'll want to do. You want to advertise your skills. However, there is quite a difference between writing a walkthrough and writing an OSINT report. And I want to highlight this. On a walkthrough, the goal is to explain your process, how you solve the challenge, how you unveil identities, how are you geolocating something. The aim is to explain your thought process step by step from beginning to end. On the other hand, in an OSINT report, the focus is on the intelligence behind it. What does it all mean? Yes, you got the answers, you unveil identities, you geolocated everything, and so what? How does that information help you, the client, or the public? What conclusions can you draw from it? And what measures can potentially be taken based on this intelligence? So this second type of report is obviously a bit hard to master. It requires the analyst to take a step back and see the bigger picture after spending possibly a considerable amount of time analyzing the small details of it all. So for beginners, wanting to start doing research, I would suggest starting with just explaining simple things. Write about how you geolocated something, how you verified an image that turned out to be old, misleading, or plain old propaganda. Then you start adding more complexity to it all. That is also something I aim to do with my exercises. When preparing them, especially the ones aimed at beginners, the first question will always be the easiest one. Afterwards, I request something a bit more challenging to force people to keep exploring instead of just stopping there. On the other hand, the hard tasks, especially the ones aimed at experts, will throw you immediately in the deep end. Often you just have one task and you need to be able to figure out where and how to start, where to move from there, and how to keep going until you reach your goal. That is not an easy task for beginners, not as impossible. It's just a lot harder because the OSINT mindset is still developing. But you'll get there, it's fine, don't rush it. So once you're comfortable writing about your OSINT investigations, you can start sharing them online in whatever platform of your choice. The goal is to be seen. Remember, people like me will find people like you. If you're writing about something that I'm monitoring, I will find you. That sounds very creepy. Not to say that you should just sit and wait, definitely not. But if you keep on producing good content, people will notice. And that's especially true if that content is very niche and no one else is investigating it. You shouldn't pick something based on what you think will look good or how much attention you'll get from it. Go for something that's close to your heart, something that drives you, the sort of topic that you just cannot stay away from. Because it's very clear to me when I'm reading or reviewing OSINT reports, if the investigation was something the analyst deeply cared about, or it was something they were just writing because they were assigned to that topic. You can feel someone's passion shining through their writing. As a team lead, I always try to match analysts with their favorite topics because it's a huge difference in the quality of their work. You cannot feign passion. Once you find what drives you and start investigating and writing about it, start looking for collaborations with other like-minded people working on similar things. I know that the Bellingcat Discord server is great for that. I actually often advise people to come here, share their ideas, their work, their progress, and see if they can find others to collaborate with. Because when you're starting, your goal is to build a good OSINT portfolio, especially if you have no background in a field related to OSINT. At this point, your CV will be irrelevant. Your new website, your blog, your social media account, they will be your new CV, your skills portfolio. It will show prospective employees what you can do, how dedicated you are, and your writing skills. And this will all be public. It's your evidence. So it's your job to make it as brilliant as possible. And yes, and I get asked this many, many times, you can absolutely get a job in OSINT with zero professional experience in this field. I know many truly amazing analysts who seem to have come from nowhere, a bit like me. No experience, no background knowledge, just pure passion and dedication. They always, always stand out. They're honestly the best professionals I work with. Nothing matches their drive to learn and improve. So find your passion and go for it. I hope this was helpful. Thank you for listening. Up to you, Charlie.
Thank you so much, Sophia, for such a clear and friendly explanation of how to get into this kind of industry, and for explaining the different types of things you can do with these skill sets as well. Stephanie in the chat said, thank you for sharing a personal situation, a terribly good way to learn about OPSEC and how to spot traces on the internet. I also shared
I was going to say that you know, it's one of these things that I thought for a while whether or not I wanted to reveal that information. But I thought I cannot explain how I got into OSINT without explaining why I had to go into OSINT, if it makes sense. So that's it. It's out now.
Yeah. So many people in the chat are saying, Mina says, this was amazing. Thank you. Shucky Ducky, which I love the name, says, so helpful and encouraging. Thank you. And Biggie Cheese says, this was definitely the clearest and most friendly advice I've gotten for getting into OSINT. So thank you. While you were talking, I also put some links in the chat, which I'll share with the podcast recording as well, which is the link to your organization, Center for Information Resilience, the link to Bellingcat's coverage of the Eye of Russia project that you worked on, and also a link to a recent Bellingcat report where we listed seven deadly sins of bad open source research. Because as you mentioned, when you're writing up those initial conclusions, so when you're first writing up those reports, it's really, really important to make sure that you're checking your own work and making sure that you're staying accurate to kind of what you found and not kind of making assumptions, because that tends to be something that we see a lot of people who are getting into OSINT do, because they're excited by the information they've found. But sometimes you can kind of jump to conclusions without realizing that you've kind of made that jump. So I just wanted to flag that as well. I wanted to ask, while people are putting their questions in the chat, I wanted to ask why you feel people should train in open source techniques in comparison to training in, I don't know, coding language or perhaps even just traditional journalism. Why did you feel like open source research was the way forward for you? And why do you think it's such an attractive kind of set of skills for employers and also for people in general?
I think OSINT kind of employs these basic skills of challenging what is being said to you on a very fundamental level. And in a, you know, in a world full of misinformation, disinformation, propaganda, those are very valuable skills in all. I mean, you can be just a student writing your thesis, but it's useful to check that, to check that the information you're getting is from a reputable source, for example. So I found that it's just a very, very fundamental skill to have in anything. I think that obviously learning coding, for example, is useful. I would say that most OSINT analysts I work with do not know coding. I feel like it's interesting that it sometimes come in, you know, it's sometimes useful because I know some of it, just a bit, but I know enough to read, for example, you know, the HTML code of a website or read the code and figure out what this is supposed to be doing. But I think on my line of work, it's mostly to analyze things like the HTML, for example. I have an exercise on that specifically. You have like three links to articles, and these are articles that were published in countries that do not use the Gregorian calendar. So it's a bit of a challenge if you're writing an OSINT report and you want to say on this date this was published, but you do not know the date, then it's one of those things. You can just go to the HTML. I'm kind of like spoiling it a bit now. You can just go and it'll give you some information. So, you know, it's useful to have some basic knowledge. I don't think it's very, you know, it's not fundamental, but it's, you know, it's useful anyway. Hope that makes sense.
Definitely makes sense. Yeah, I always surprise actually how much coding comes up in conversations, but how many researchers don't need it. And I just posted a link in the chat to one of our more recent videos where Agnish from our team, who's on our tech team, who definitely knows how to code, was talking you through how to use Jupyter Notebooks and Google Collab as well, which is a way of using open source research tools without knowing coding language, which can be useful for people as well. We have so many questions coming flooding in now. Lumos asks, thank you. Can you tell us more about how you felt in your first role in the Eyes on Russia project? How did you feel when you first got involved with that?
Oh, okay. So that was overwhelming. That was insane overwhelming because I went from being, you know, just geolocating cool pictures I found online to now my job was mostly to geolocate because we had a massive database by then. And, you know, there's so much content coming that it had to be verified, geolocated, you know, added to the map eventually. So it was very overwhelming. It was definitely a trial by fire, if that makes sense. But there's some good aspects of it because I definitely learned a lot of it. And there were some bad aspects of it because I was forced to experience things that I was most definitely not ready to be experiencing, if that makes sense. And I'll tell you a story. So, you know, the two databases, so I have my normal job and the Eyes on Russia project, and both of them have a database. And the database is where we collect all the information that we want to archive. So everything that's photos, videos, you know, any audio goes there, gets archived. So it's not lost. If it gets deleted from the online, you know, social media, then it's just archived. And so all entries have a rating on violence level. And this rating varies from 1 to 5, being 1, everything's fine, there's nothing horrendous on this picture. 2, you might see some threats, verbal threats or something like that, maybe some damage. On 3, you're going to see maybe some beating, perhaps blood, bruises, some sort of aggression. On 4, you're going to see a body. And on 5, that body is going to be in a very bad condition. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to be very sensible on my normal job and I am just going to look at the 1s and the 2s. I'm not taking care of anything else until I'm comfortable enough to move up and then more, you know, horrible content. And that was great. I was so good. I was so proud of myself. I was like, oh yeah, I'm going to be so good at this. And then I go to the Eyes on Russia project, and this was during the weekend. And I was going through the database again. I was just clicking, geolocating. And there was something that felt wrong. I'm not sure if wrong is the word, because suddenly there were dozens of links entered on the database and there was nothing else. They didn't have a rating. They didn't have description, didn't have category. And it felt like someone just had to dump all these things because something very big had happened. And there was just like the need to quickly archive this. So, you know, I completely understand it had to be done. And I was alone. I was completely alone on that day on that database because it was probably like a Sunday and I was just working because why wouldn't I? And I just start clicking and I start geolocating and I start clicking and I start geolocating. And at the time, I didn't realize how much that was affecting me, because I'm not going to describe what I was watching, obviously, but it was something that happened that had a lot of civilian casualties. It was something that made international news everywhere. It was a very bad incident and it was covered everywhere. And I was like the first person, well, technically the second after whoever put those links there, to go through all of it. And I was looking frame by frame, video by video, picture by picture. And it was very, very bad. And when I finally stopped, you know, like it was time to go to bed and I was like, I am done. I realized how much that had affected me. And I had a completely breakdown, completely. It was horrible. It was such an enormous thing to experience. And I feel like that was something that I was not prepared to deal with. And now, obviously, there's been a lot of policies put into place. And, you know, and also I know when to stop. But I think there's something that when I think of the Eyes on Russia project at the beginning, that is what I think about, that trauma that I had to deal with. Well, I dealt it, not like I had to, I just did it anyway. So here you go. Lots of information. I was just like sharing everything now. Next question.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about it a lot in these stage talks, actually, keeping yourself mentally healthy and mentally sane when viewing these things. And especially if you're thinking about going into a niche that involves human rights or conflict, you need to kind of be aware that this kind of material might come across your plate and how to deal with it. I'll share a few resources in the chat as well. Ah, Meryl's already done it. My colleague Meryl's just shared a guide for mental health hygiene in the chat. It's really, really important that you kind of keep that at the forefront of your mind. And there's some really useful tools online as well that can help kind of obscure some of the image for you while you're looking at different parts of the image, for example, or mute the sound, which can also be highly triggering. But we've got a lot of other stage talks on our SoundCloud that you can listen back to specifically on mental health while doing open source research. We have so many questions, so if you don't mind, I'll keep going.
Yeah, go.
Bishti has asked, and I hope I've pronounced that right, Bishti, has asked, how do you pick images for your geolocation challenges? How do you select them?
Okay, so there's many ways I do that. So the first thing is that when I come up with exercise ideas, I based on specific skills I want to talk about. So my goal is always to have an educational side of it. So then I think of something. And for example, it could be I want to do geolocation that just requires satellite image. You cannot use Google Street View. You cannot use anything like that. That's it. Like the first one, my first exercise is like that. So in that case, honestly, I would just go to a random place on the map and I was like, this is a good one. And then I, you know, try to find the name of whatever next village nearby is. And then I start using keywords about that village. Could be the name of the village. And the first one would be the name of the village. It could be I'll try to find geotagged content like on YouTube. And then I'll like do a screenshot of someone or a location somewhere. Sometimes if I want to be a bit more challenging, I have one where it's it was a photo of a military aircraft from the US. And so I went to the US State Department. I think I'm not sure if it was that one or not. And I just tried to find something that just said undisclosed location. So I would just put that in brackets, undisclosed location, not brackets, sorry, quotation marks. And I just see, let's see what kind of photos are undisclosed. Well, until I come to them, then it will be disclosed and so on. So it really varies. Sometimes my focus is on the area. So I'll have a very specific area. I try to have as many areas of the globe as possible. So I don't want it to be too centered on Europe, too centered on the US, too centered on Russia. I want everything because all countries have their issues. And it's interesting to just look at them, especially when you have no idea what's going on them. And sometimes that happens to me. I'll be like, let me just come up with a random country and see what's happening there. And then I'll go and check pictures from the news and so on. So it's a bit chaotic. It's a bit random because I feel like adding that randomness creates an extra challenge that I enjoy because I also need to solve them in the first place, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's great that you're thinking about trying to cover different areas of the world as well, particularly as when you're first starting geolocation, you might not be aware of the limitations to some regions of the world in terms of satellite mapping and image access. I also want to shout out that your colleague, Bender Strick, also does a really great YouTube series as well called Bender Brown, which also showcases a lot of useful tips and tricks for open source researchers. So also worth checking that out, as well as Sophia's fantastic exercises. CR has asked, excited to try these challenges. When it comes to a portfolio, is there an ideal format that seems to be most popular, blog post versus a plain site? I get it depends on your audience too, but what would you advise? How would you advise creating your portfolio? What would you make it look like?
Well, that's a tough question because I am not am not involved in any hiring, so I'm not sure what other people are looking at. I feel like I tend to prefer blog entries. Could be on a website. You can just have, you know, a blog, a blog on your own, or sometimes people put on LinkedIn, you know, like as a post. I'm not sure how you call that. I tend to not prefer, I don't enjoy too much Twitter threads. I find that it's very hard to read them, if it makes sense. And they're also very focused on the images. And I think when you're writing, you want to be explaining things. So limiting the character is not ideal. So I think blog posts, I would say they're the best thing because you can make them as big or as small. You can make a series if you want to. So they give you, you know, a lot of allowances. You can do whatever you want. You know, once you have it, it's yours. So I think those are quite good. At least that's what I've been using and that's what I see other people using. And I think they're quite, you know, they're very nice.
Thank you. Moving swiftly on, Bishti's also asked another question about limiting yourself while writing reports, because often people tend to find themselves writing too much. So how long or short should intelligence reports be? And then CR has added on top of that, is there a good place to ask for feedback when you do write such a report? Where did you go in the early days for feedback on some of your early reports?
Okay. So yeah, how long? Okay. That I feel like that is a problem that all OSINT analysts have because we just know so much. When you're investigating something, you know everything, you know all the details and you want to explain all the tiny details. And most of the times the reader does not care about the details. They just want the information. They want it the digested information. So I would say in terms of number of pages, if that makes sense, I would say two. Two is how, well, to be fair, I tend to aim at two and end up with four anyway, but that's pictures, so that's fine. I can do that. But yeah, just try to keep it as clear as possible. What you usually do is that you'll explain things and then you link to the sources. So you don't have to, you know, describe everything. You can just say, oh, this is what, you know, there's a photo that showed this, and then you just link to that photo without having to, you know, put everything on it. If people want more information, they can click the link and then, you know, get, you know, the information of where you got that information, that source and so on. So I would say keep it short-ish. And that's mostly because you want to make sure that the people will keep on reading, you know, until halfway through, because otherwise they'll just, you know, most people that will read your reports are probably going to be people that do not have much time to read too much information. So they want intelligence. That's it. They don't want how you got to that. They don't want to learn about all the steps and that tiny detail and that video. And then you found this person and then you did this thing. They don't care about any of that. They want intelligence. If you're writing a blog post and you want to showcase your skills, then definitely explain how you got there. Because when someone like a prospective employee is looking at it, they want to see that you're capable of making those steps and do this analysis and, you know, like find these identities, geolocate these things. So this is skills that they will be looking for. But in terms of the reader, that's why I explain the difference between an OSINT report and a walkthrough. They're quite different things. I'm sure there was a second and a third question, but I didn't write it down.
Yeah, the second question actually relates to the question I was going to ask now. So a lot of people are asking where they can find examples of good practice reports and where they can get feedback on their reports. Have you got any tips on that?
Okay, so good practice reports. Well, there are many reports being written online. Bellingcat has reports or articles. I'm not sure how you describe, but you know they are there. CR has, there's a few projects that publish reports, the Eyes on Russia project, the Afghan Witness project, the Myanmar Witness project. So all of them have reports, and then you can read and see more or less what style they are. And I guess you can guide yourself through with that. In terms of feedback, that is harder because obviously when you're working, you'll have someone to give feedback. I'm the person that gives feedback to other people. When you're not working, then that's obviously makes it harder. I would suggest getting other OSINT people to read your articles because I feel like I have that problem at work as well because I review everyone's reports, but who's reviewing mine, right? Like, you know, who watches The Watchmen? So I tend to ask other analysts, like, can you look at my own reports, which I hate. I hate when people comment in on it. I'm like, no, it was perfect. What are you doing? But no, sometimes it's not perfect and I need to change it. So it's always good to have an extra pair of eyes. And it doesn't even have to be an OSINT person. You can just give it to your mom or dad and be like, if you were to read this, do you understand? Because again, there's different types of OSINT, you know, and if your article is for public, you know, it could be anyone. Anyone could just pick it up and read it and it needs to be understandable. People will be reading it and you're like, what do you mean by this? I've never heard this concept before because it could be something that everyone knows in OSINT, but out of OSINT, no one knows about it. So it's very useful to have, you know, like extra pair of eyes from all walks of life, not just OSINT. That's it. I hope makes sense.
Definitely. And I would just like to plug that in the Bellingcat Discord server, we have channels like publication preparation, cries for help, show your work, where you can kind of ask for that kind of last checks or help with those kinds of things as well. I'm not encouraging you to all post all of your 60 page works in the channels, but asking people for help there is definitely encouraged. So please do reach out. Mm-hmm. Satanta has asked a very common question that Bellingcat often face actually, which is without cybersecurity expertise, how do you protect yourself while researching potentially dangerous topics or organizations? Any advice
right,
on that?
So yes, I do understand that. Like in my case, I feel like I kind of learned that the hard way before cybersecurity was even a topic I knew about. So it's hard for me to understand. I feel like there's a few ways to protect yourself, obviously. I feel like people as well exaggerate how much protection they need. Sometimes, you know, the key word being sometimes, because I see people like you need in like, a virtual machine with whatever, you know, super exciting operating system and some crazy tools. And if you're just going to check Twitter, you don't need that. That's a bit too much, isn't it? If then you're going to, for example, investigate extremist organization propaganda, and you need to get into these very specific channels, which I shall not name, then you definitely need some sort of protection because you just never know what's going to happen. So there's a few things that if you are going to go into places that will possibly get you on a list, you should definitely do. So things like you have a burner phone and you have a burner SIM card, and I have that, just like an old phone that I don't use anymore, cleaned everything just reset, buy a SIM card from like for 20p from eBay. It's not associated with me in any way, and that is just used to register on websites that require. So like, for example, Facebook, they need your phone number. That's my phone number now. They need a new email. I'll create a new email. So I'll have a browser that's my working browser, and nothing on that browser can connect to me in any way whatsoever. And you know, and that gets cleaned all the time. If I click, you know, close the browser, everything gets purged and everything has to be logged in again. So there's a few basic things. I don't think people need to go overboard again if they're doing investigation that just requires like social media, geolocations, analyzing pictures. But if you do then get into more like, you know, deeper rabbit holes, then definitely you need to read into how to stay safe. But you don't need a cybersecurity course, just some basic knowledge. And also, once you start getting into OSINT and you can see how much information you can get from very specific things like, you know, in photo, then you start getting very careful about what you post online. And also, I would suggest every so often just do OSINT on you. See how much you can find about yourself, anything that you left behind, a blog post, some social media profile that you forgot existed, go back, purge everything, delete everything. And, you know, that's it. It doesn't require too much, I think.
Have you ever worked on dark or deep web OSINT? Somebody in the chat is asking a question about that.
No. I don't do that. There are a few members of my team that do that, but that is not my department. So I do not do that, no.
Great. Thank you so much for that really important advice. And yeah, just making sure that you're using kind of research profiles when you're searching anybody on social media as well is really important, keeping it away from your personal profiles as much as possible. Stephanie asked a really interesting question. How can you tell the difference between passion and work? And thinking about your sleep and about trauma and also the large number of people who are looking for a job in open source research because they love investigating and analyzing this or that field. And of the recruiters who ask what are your salary expectations as a junior. So how do you tell the difference between passion and work?
Okay, I think for me, it's very clear. At the end of the day, it's like 6 p.m., I'm done for the day. Do I walk away from it or do I just open another tab and I'm looking at something else? So that is the difference for me. If I just keep on going, it doesn't matter if it's weekend, it doesn't matter if it's, you know, 6 a.m. and I'm like, you know what I should do? I should look at that geolocation. I should look at that picture. I need to solve that. I feel like that is passion. If you're just doing it because you have to, then that's a job. And, you know, it's fine. Sometimes you can have one without the other. But, you know, when you have them combined, that's just heaven. I love it.
As we're running out of time, we've only got 10 minutes left. So please put your final questions in the chat now. Shuki Duki actually asked a question that I wanted to ask as well, which is based on your experience and observations of the field, what areas or topics do you think are currently undeserved or in high demand for open source researchers?
Oh, God, that is a very hard question. I don't know. That is my answer. I just do not know because I feel like whenever I, you know, I go and I want to look at some random country for, you know, an idea for an exercise, I just come across so much that I had no idea what's going on there. And that's always a surprise to me. I'm just like, oh, whoa, I had never come across this. I didn't know there was an issue in going on in this country or this region of the world. And I feel like maybe the best way is to find something, like I said, that's close to your heart. Maybe it could be, you know, where you live or where you're from, could be different things. Something that, you know, when you go to Twitter or when you go to Facebook or whatever, the things that you just keep on checking, you keep on Googling, you keep on wanting to know more about it. Because again, like I said, when I was speaking, it's best to do something that drives you than to try to find something that you feel will get attention or is not getting enough attention. Just find something that you want to do.
Yeah, passion is definitely important because you're going to be staring at the same piece of information or the same set of information for a while. but a lot of people fall into things that are familiar to them as well. So covering countries, for example, where they speak the language, where they're familiar with the landscape, because it's often easier if you, for geolocation purposes at least. Zal Daysticks earlier asked, if you're doing that kind of thing, if you're kind of falling into familiar territory for yourself, how do you avoid getting your biases in the way? How do you investigate something and make sure that you're not harming anybody with biases when doing open source reporting?
It's very hard because I do investigate the same area of the globe every single day. But I also do as part of a team. So, you know, we all keep our, you know, each other in check, if that makes sense. And sometimes I'll write something and be like, no, that's wrong. And I'm like, damn it. So I think it's always best if you can collaborate with other people because they do provide, you know, a different perspective than yours. And I feel like that is also so valuable. And most of my most of my reports, I do them alone. I write them alone. But, you know, it's just so important to have that someone else to just come in and look at it. So, like I said, the Bellingcat server is a good one. So you can go and it's divided in like topics, isn't it? And you can go and see what other people are talking about because maybe, yeah, you are stuck in our biases. And also, I would suggest, like I said, I have a different browser for work. So that browser gets purged every day, like all cookies go, everything. So it kind of resets. So anything that I was looking for or looking around the previous day is no longer impacting, hopefully, my results. And I think that's important to just get a clear slate, you know, because we get a lot, search engines and platforms try to track what you like and try to give you more of that. So my suggestion, just don't give them that. Just purge everything. Just like give me the clean slate and let's see what you got.
Exactly. Algorithms try to box you in and this can sometimes leave you blind. I wanted to ask, is there any tools that you found more useful when you were a beginner that you now perhaps no longer use as an expert or any that have become a staple as part of your research that you think are worth shouting out?
So the short answer is no. I feel like tools come and go and I tend to not get attached to them too much because you just never know. Next time I'm going to search for it, they're just gone. It's, however, something I see a lot in the online OSINT community. They just this need to find and collect OSINT tools for everything. There's a list of this and top 5 and top 10 tools for whatever. And I'm sure some of them are very useful, but I tend to not just bother with any of them. I like to stick to the basics and try to use search engines to find information. You have Google Yandex, Bing Maps, alongside Google Earth Pro for satellite imagery, because I spend a lot of my time looking at photos and videos and noticing the tiny details of it all. So it's mostly what I do. I also feel like the most important thing about any tools is to master them, to learn in depth what they can or cannot do, because you know, that's it. You learn how to do things that most people probably don't know about. And I'll give a quick example. So I did a geolocation that I wrote about a while ago. I think it was last year. And it was at a time where a Wagner convoy was heading to Moscow. It's a big thing. And everyone was just like in a big brouhaha. And there was a video of excavators digging a road. Apparently it was to stop this convoy from reaching Moscow. And I was tasked to find, you know, this geolocate this thing. And what I used at the time was that I went to Google Maps and I knew more or less, you know, the area that they were, you know, from they were heading in a specific direction. They were heading towards Moscow. I knew where they were before. So I kind of had a more general idea and I was looking for big roads because, you know, there were tanks and stuff. They need space. And I end up using the traffic option on Google Maps, which is not used that often. So people will use it if they need to navigate, for example, and they want to see how much traffic is in a specific area. But because when I saw that video, I saw that when the excavators were digging the road, there was a queue of cars forming behind them. So I thought, if I put this live thing that shows the traffic of this area, I would say that the red bits is where the traffic is forming. That's where this likely took place. So I went straight to that area, check Google Street View, because apparently they did have it, which was great. And I just geolocated. So that's what I mean. Like, you know, everyone knows how to use Google Maps, but not everyone will know how to use this very specific option of Google Maps. And so just, I would suggest people to just play with everything, click everything. I'm always clicking everything. And I keep up with any changes to this. So I follow things about Google News and maps. So whenever anything is introduced or removed, I'm aware of it. And I can just, you know, make sure that I can either use it or stop using and find an alternative. So it's less about the tools and more about your expertise in using them.
That's really, really good advice. Just on that topic, then, as we're wrapping up, what kind of barriers should people expect to face when trying to get into this industry and trying to get into open source research? And how might you advise they overcome them?
I think that there's a few barriers in terms of skills, obviously. So if you're investigating something, like I said, you know, I applied for the Eyes on Russia project and they wanted someone who spoke the language. That's the barrier for me specifically. Language is definitely a very high demand skill. But I think the biggest barrier that I see nowadays is that there are still many organizations hiring based on CV, and that is not how you get a talent. The talent is not coming from the CV. At most, you'll get someone that can write CVs very well. The talent are, you know, the people that dedicate and do things. And I feel like that is an overall thing. But that, I think this, the problem is if you have a small organization, then it's likely that the people that will be doing the hiring will be people that know about OSINT. If you have a big organization, chances are the people hiring are the people that are like HR or something like that, or management. And those will be looking at CV because they don't know what skills they need. And I feel like that is a problem in any organization, in any industry, not just this one. But I think in OSINT specifically, the absolute best analyst I ever worked with were people that do not have, you know, didn't have like the ideal CV. They didn't have anything to do with OSINT. And I feel like if they were looking at their CV at the beginning, they would not have a job. No one even looked at my CV. I never sent my CV to anyone. They were just like, hey, yeah, you can join in. And that's it. So I was happy for that. I'm very happy for that. But I feel like we need to let more people in based on the skills rather than what they have done so far.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I could not agree more. And that's part of the reason why I was so desperate to chat to you today. And thank you so, so much for today's talk. It's been fascinating. We've learned a few things. We've learned not to depend on tools. Practice, practice, practice. Identify your niche and identify your passion. And that the industry needs to recognize all the hard people working out there on these kinds of things. So thank you so much, Sophia, for a fantastic talk. Is there any other resources that you want to kind of highlight quickly other than your own fantastic website?
Yes, I want that. Yes, I'm very excited about that. Okay, so one of the things that I've told already is that I ask people to, when they solve my exercises and when they write walkthroughs, to please give me the links. And so then I put them on my page. So, you know, like on my page, each exercise has a page, and on them, I will list everyone that has written a walkthrough. And I feel like that is a gold mine of knowledge. I love reading those walkthroughs because very often they come from people that have no experience in OSINT, and somehow they're thinking, they're using methods, they're using strategy that would never occur to me. And they just, it's brilliant. And I'll get people from all walks of life, people from all sides of this planet, you know, all corners, and they just solve the exact same thing that I've done and many others have done, but they use a technique that no one else has used. And I think this is, it's just brilliant. I absolutely invite people to read other people's work. And some of them, are, honestly, they're raw talent. And I keep telling them. And I am always so sad when sometimes they message me and they're like, here's my walkthrough. Please don't publish. I'm not comfortable. I'm not confident enough. And I read it and it's like the most brilliant piece of work. And I was like, why wouldn't I publish? This is brilliant. Please keep writing. Please, if you ever change your mind, just let me know. I want to publish this. You should be very proud of it. And that's it. That's a good resource.
Fantastic. So Sophia wants to know if you've tried her exercises, and please do get in touch. All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening. I'm going to end the recording here, but thank you so much for your time today. And in 2 weeks' time, we'll be back with another stage talk. My colleague Meryl will be presenting it. Thank you so much, everybody.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the stage talk. If you'd like to catch a stage talk live where you can ask the guest questions, join the Bellingcat Discord server by visiting www.discord.gg/Bellingcat. The music you've heard is titled Dawn by Newer Self and is courtesy of Artlist.